Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger? Poor disgusting Salinger. Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is a returning host from our third episode, Carla Kurtzinger.
Hey, John. Now, yeah, that's interesting. I was on the third episode. What episode number is this?
Oh, my God. It's somewhere in the 70s now. I mean, I can...
Wow.
I should know what my own podcast is here.
I didn't know how many you'd had. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's been going on now for 3 years. So
wow.
Anyway. We are getting old. All of us are getting old, and Carla is a very good friend of mine from pre-internet days, but we met working at an internet company, so not really pre-internet.
No, yeah, it was kind of the beginning of my internet world.
Now you want to introduce yourself and tell everyone out there what you do and who you are?
Oh, sure, yeah. I'm Carla Kurtzinger, John's friend and co-worker back in the days. We met when we both worked on the Car Talk website for NPR, and before that I'd worked on the website for Hallmark.com. That was a long time ago. I feel like you're right. We are old. I still do a little bit of website stuff freelance, but really now I pretty much focus on communications training and event management, some social media. So I still do a little bit of web here and there, but most of the time I'm on the road. Traveling to an event or a conference or a roundtable, doing training or hosting. So I'm on the road quite a bit, but it is nice sometimes to still dabble in the internet and to be on your show, John.
Well, I'm sorry it's been taking us so long to have you back. We were chatting over Messenger and you brought up the book that we're doing this time. You want to talk a little bit about your history with this book, which is John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany?
I feel like I have so much history with this book. You have to remind me what year this book came out, John. You probably know.
I have it right here in my notes. It was 1989.
Right. So that was probably right after, I'm sure I read this probably when it came out or probably within the year it came out. To age myself, I had just gotten out of college probably at that point or at some point. But I was a big fan of John Irving. I had read a few of his novels previous to Owen Meany. And so as soon as it came out, I wanted to read it. And this is the book that I, if anyone asks, what's the book you want to have with you on a desert island? Owen Meany. If I fill out any Facebook survey or any internet, anything, anybody ask about your favorite book of all time, it's The Prayer for Owen Meany. And I think I just read it at a perfect time in my life. But so it spoke to me on many levels. But I have recommended this book to everybody, including you, John. And I have reread it probably once a year since, or maybe once every 2 years since 1989. So it spoke to me on a very personal level. But I think it's a book that everyone would enjoy if they read it. And I think most of the people that I've recommended it to have enjoyed it.
Now, I'm going to shock everyone out there in the podcast world by saying I have read hardly any John Irving. John Irving, I remember when the movie of The World According to Garp came out, and I saw it, I believe, on HBO. I must have been a teenager at the time. Now, The World According to Garp was not Irving's first book, but it was his first highly successful book.
Yes.
It was the book that made his name. and later the movie that made the that launched the movie career of Robin Williams and also of a young John Lithgow, and I believe that was also the first movie Glenn Close was in.
Yeah, I mean, it had major star power in it. Like, to your point, they were early in their careers, but
Yeah.
and I will,
And
yeah, go ahead.
no, you.
I was going to say, really, though, of all his books, World According to Garp is not my favorite of the in the John Irving library, but it, you know, it is a great film, and but there were many other Irving books that I enjoyed, you know, Cider House Rules or and now I'm sitting here blanking, which is terrible. I feel like I've read so many, but they are all eclipsed by A Prayer
Hotel New
from
Hampshire is the
Hotel New
other.
Hampshire, absolutely. Yeah. And then and others that I didn't enjoy later in his career. So, but I've at least tried most of the ones that he's written.
When I saw the movie, I kind of liked the movie, but was a little, it's a very compressed movie. Irving is known for writing extremely long, dense, and event-filled books. He's often compared to Charles Dickens in that way. And so I tried to read The World According to Garp. I must have been all of 12 or 13. That's not a good time in your life to be reading any John Irving, let alone The World According to Garp. So I left him by the wayside. And then later on, when I became more interested in literature in college and in grad school, I always associated Irving with genteel New England white male authorship. You know, I put him in the in there with like John Updike, who Irving has often complained people confuse the two of them. I put him up there with like John Cheever and even someone like Philip Roth, who is not he was not New Englander. He is very much New York and very Jewish, whereas Irving is very white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. But I kind of felt like this is the literature of the baby boom, and it didn't I had decided it didn't speak to me. And now I'm trying now that I am an older, wiser person to open my heart and read things that I thought were not for me, and I'm going back to this now. I find that some of my suspicions were confirmed and some of them were not confirmed by reading this book. It's certainly a very engaging book as long as it is, and it's a very, very long book. It's like 600 pages long in the edition that I was reading it in. Easy to read if you're the kind of person who likes to read, again, Charles Dickens.
A couple of things. I'll respond to a couple of things. As far as John Irving goes, I do think, especially if you lined up photographs of the authors that you mentioned, I can see how you would easily mix up John Irving with, you know, John Cheever and John Updike, and their names even sound the same. But I feel like John Irving has and I will say, Prayer for Owen Meany is really shows a lot of the really I feel like is personal to John Irving because it is the white you know New England it's very you know it's very talks a lot about religion meaning of life that kind of stuff it, to me it is very much if you're describing John Irving I think it is very much that but I do think John Irving in contrast to those other authors many of his novels not so much Owen Meany. They're just, it shows that John Irving just has a fascination with really odd topics. And so that's why some of his other, maybe some of his other books I had a harder time finishing or I wasn't as interested in, you know, just a lot of, and this is going to say too much about me, but, you know, just a lot about like circus folk or like he's very, very into, and I'm trying to think, you know, like Little People or, gosh, I'm trying to think. They're just kind of that edge of society that maybe I'm not, to your point, like, you know, things that you think were not for you. Some of the subject matter to me seemed to be a little edge or a little too edgy for me. And when I start reading, I'd say, why is every book that John Irving writes have little people in it, or there's kind of that circus element to it, or that, you know, like this group of people in society that I'm not sure are my, you know, it's not people I normally encounter, and do I want to read a book and spend 600 pages with them? Does that make sense?
You can speak to this better than I can, too, but when I was doing the research for this and reading up on John Irving's life, it was interesting to note that there are many, many autobiographical notes in this book, in The Prayer for Owen Nimini, but there are also autobiographical notes in The World According to Garp. There are themes that he keeps returning to again and again.
And again and again.
Like the main character of this book. Irving came from a broken home. His father was absent. He didn't know what happened to him. It turned out that his father had been in the war and had been shot down in a plane, which is something that happens to at least the biological father from The World According to Garp. And Irving was raised by a stepfather who happened to be on the board of the Phillips Exeter Academy, which is a plot line here in A Prayer for Owen Meany. So he's making use of these personal events throughout his work. So maybe a lot of these things, these obsessions, are the ways in which he conflates real life with his fictional world.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And I will say, though, with some of the other books by John Irving that I have either struggled to get through or, you know, they just didn't really capture me. I will say with The Prayer for Owen Meany, what really singles it out in my experience is that I think is probably one of the best opening paragraphs of any book I have ever read. And the tragic thing is that I did not pull my copy off of the shelf, which is in my living room. I just am now attached to my computer and cannot go to it. But I think it's one of the most compelling opening paragraphs ever. And when I read that first paragraph, I just thought, well, there's no way I cannot finish this book, because he set up, you know, the situation, or he set up Owen and his best friend, and then am I telling too much? I mean, I feel like that opening paragraph just tells you, it draws you in, and I don't know how anybody could not finish the book or not read the book.
I am doomed to remember a boy with a wrecked voice. Not because of his voice or because he was the smallest person I ever knew, or even because he was the instrument of my mother's death, but because he is the reason I believe in God. I am a Christian because of Owen Meany. I make no claims to have a life in Christ or with Christ, and certainly not for Christ, which I've heard some zealots claim.
Also, the character of Owen, to your point, this 600-plus page book, this is probably the only book I can remember in my history where I was so sad that a book ended, and I was so sad that this person, this Owen, you know, which is one of Irving's little people, right? Who never, you know, got bigger and had a wrecked voice, and so every word that's written in the book is in capital letters, so you can tell it was like an internal scream. I was really sad that he wasn't a real person. I mean, and that's the experience I had with Owen. So I want people to read this, because I think Owen is just this amazing character that should be a real person. I wish he was a real person.
Irving is an interesting character because he is a guy who has some literary cred. He gets reviewed by the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker and stuff, and he gets the academic writing about him, but he's also a huge bestseller, or at least was a huge bestseller during his heydays of the 70s and the 80s. He's a product of the Iowa Writers Workshop, which is probably the most famous creative writing program in America. There's a lot of controversy over writing programs. I myself am also the product of a writing program, but I am not a successful author. So Irving's teacher at the Iowa Writers Workshop was Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, wow.
And that, I think, may also go a long way to explain a little bit of his affinity for oddness and for surreal and sometimes violent turns in his stories.
Well, I did not know that. So that explains so much.
I'm not going to give a plot summary per se, but we can talk about elements of the plot and, you know, obviously spoilers to anyone out there. But I don't think, you know, we need to be holding back discussing any part of this book that was written, again, in 1989.
30 years old. Spoilers. Yeah, that's hilarious.
So this is the story of John Wheelwright, who's the narrator, coming of age story of him as he grows up in New Hampshire, along with his pal Owen Meany, who, as you mentioned, is a little person. As the book opens, it opens actually in the present day, which for the book is 1987, the final years of the Reagan administration. And Wheelwright is thinking back on his childhood on the occasion of his living in Canada, where he teaches at a private girls' school. That's also an autobiographical thing, by the way. Irving taught at one of the Seven Sisters schools. One of them.
I believe you. I haven't read up too much on Irving. Even though I've read his books, I've never been that concerned about him as a person. I feel bad now.
Wheelwright remembers growing up in New Hampshire in the 50s. The book, a lot of the events take place in 1953. And Meany has a wrecked voice. As you mentioned, he speaks in this high-pitched voice, which is rendered throughout the book entirely in capital letters. And that is carried through when Owen writes as well. And in this book, several times he writes letters, he writes articles for newspapers. Those are all in caps as well, which is a startling feature on the page. As you go through this book, it's certainly the thing that gives this book most of its flavor.
An interesting thing too is, like you said, this book came out in 1989, so this predates now when we see anybody type anything in all caps, we think yelling, but this predated that concept of all caps is yelling, right? So it's like John Irving was a little bit of, you know, he saw that, you know, he saw that coming. So let's give it up for John Irving. He invented the screaming all cap letters. So I just wanted to point that out.
Well, you know, as I was reading this through, it becomes clear rapidly in this book that Owen Meany is something of a Christ figure, and that's not, you don't have to dig hard for that, because Wheelwright himself basically says as much. And one of the first things that happens to Owen Meany is he gets hung up on a hook in the schoolroom. Owen is obsessed with God, obsessed with this belief he develops that he is an instrument of God's, and that he needs to resign himself to whatever fate God has for him. But what I bring this up to say is what this all caps thing reminded me of was a red letter edition of the Bible, if you've ever seen one of those where all of Jesus's dialogue is rendered in red. That was a thing that was developed in America, actually, in the 19th century. It's more of a Protestant thing than a Catholic thing, I believe. And that's important because a lot of this book is about Protestantism and Catholicism and Owen's criticisms of both. But it really reminded me of that. It reminded me of, if you open up one of those Bibles, you see all of Christ, whenever Christ says anything, it's in red. And so you have all these words leaping out at you on the page. And the other thing it reminded me of is the way that traditionally in the King James Version, they would always capitalized Lord God or Jehovah which are translations of the Hebrew Yahweh. There's kind of built into that a lot of symbolism. This book is just like rife with symbols that you can't help but want to take things allegorically as you read this book. At least me. I don't know about you. Did you?
Oh yeah, I like that. To your point, I think Irving did symbols both of, you know, the fact that Owen is this Christ-like figure, and then a lot of, and they were so obvious, right? It wasn't like he was being subtle about the symbolism, but also there's even a stuffed armadillo that figures in a little bit later in the book, and then we see like the armadillo's arms are missing, which doesn't really. Yeah, it's like, okay, they're missing, but then you realize that is a foreshadowing of something, an event much later in the book, and all these things about arms, missing arms, and it's not really evident why the arms are an issue until you get to the very end of the book. He really, I think, like I said, to me, that's why rereading the book is such a joy for me, because if you see how artfully that he actually built that book, even though the symbols are very obvious, but then there are some that he's actually like building a path toward the final scene or the final.
Right. Yeah. No, definitely. Armlessness and amputation in general is a huge theme through this book. John has a grandmother who is very wealthy, who has a maid, who has to have a leg amputated early in this book. His mother has a dressmaker's form, which is armless, and shows up both in childhood and then later in the adult timeline. It becomes important. There's an event in the middle of the book involving Owen taking the arms off of a statue of Mary Magdalene and placing that statue inside a school, and he takes the arms and uses them himself. There's the armadillos, and there's the final sequence in the book. We can hold off and talking about that, because the book does, as you say, prefigure a lot of stuff that is all revealed rather rapidly. Uh-huh. In the last 10-20 pages of the book.
And I have to say, I think about, and not that this movie has anything to do with the Prayer and me, but, you know, for everyone, and hopefully everyone has seen The Sixth Sense, you know, at the very end of the movie, and please, everyone, I hope you've seen The Sixth Sense, at the very end of the movie, when you realize that Bruce Willis's character is actually dead, and now I feel guilty saying that, but then they rapidly show all the scenes in the movie where it should have been obvious that you knew, you know, that he was actually not alive. I felt like that's almost how, when you get to the end of OME, it's like suddenly you see it, like all the obvious arrows that were pointing to that, what happened, like all the ways that Irving had drawn it, this little path for you, and suddenly it's like, how did I not know this was coming?
Right. But the other thing that's funny about all of these symbols is they are obvious, they are broad. There are characters in this book that are obvious and broad too, almost cartoonish. That's another way that that Irving is a bit like Dickens, in that he's not afraid to paint with very broad brushes and have characters who are just despicable and characters who are just venal or horrible in one way or another. Sometimes as I was reading this through, I felt a little bit of tonal whiplash between something of the seriousness with which Irving was treating his themes and something of the goofiness of some of the events that happen in this book. I mentioned this whole sequence involving the statue of Mary Magdalene. Before that, it comes down to the fact that Owen Meany, while they're still at the school, in the fictionalized school here is in this small town,
Gravesend Academy.
Right. The town is called Gravesend, which is also, you know, great,
great name.
Place naming. And Owen has it in for a teacher who keeps parking in his space. He has some kids take the car and park it inside the school by basically carrying it in, which results in the teachers angrily trying to remove it and it causing destruction inside the school. Owen eventually is expelled, but in return he takes this statue of Mary Magdalene and dearms it and puts it into the school. And I just feel like it's such a kind of like an Animal House move in the middle of a book that's supposed to be about, you know, the crisis of faith in America and the and about the encroaching modernity. And I don't know what to make of it in some ways. You know, I feel like Irving is aware of the strangeness of what he's doing.
Well, yeah, and I think I guess because I've read other books by Irving, I feel like there's always that little bit of freakishness about his of the worlds that his characters inhabit. That even to your point, and here you have this New England town. It seems like a very conservative town. They've got this boys' school, or, you know, whatever. But there's always this little freakish element where weird things happen. And it's funny when I read, now when you pointed out to me, I'm like, yeah, I guess that is kind of weird. But in Owen and Ellen's world, that seemed like, you know, sure that would happen to Owen, right? Because again, the statue of Mary came into it, and it was another opportunity for that religious, you know, for him to take that little religious stab. It kind of made sense to me at the time. It seems odd now that you pointed out.
Another main plot point of the book is that John does not know who his father is. His mother is a single mother who keeps telling him as a child that she will eventually explain who his father is. Owen, by the way, has a huge crush on John's mom. There's a lot of weird sexuality in this book. Owen is obsessed with John's mom's breasts. And says so much to John, and John doesn't seem to be too fazed by that. He seems to take it in stride. Unfortunately, Owen is also responsible, on accident, for John's mom's eventual death back in 1953, when Owen is playing baseball and hits a foul ball into Owen's mother, breaking her neck, I guess.
It just kills her instantly. I think it hit her in the head or something, and she just...
Yeah, for a lot of the book, he's trying to figure out, John wonders who his father is, and very late in the book, he learns that his father was the pastor of the local church that that Owen and John attended as a child. This very hesitant, doubt-filled, sort of an uninteresting man. He learns of it, by the way, by through a visitation from Owen, which Owen is dead at this point. Owen's eventual death is another thing that the book is building up to. It is the event that the book is building up to is Owen's death. And when he learns about this, he's so disgusted by learning that his father is his father, and also learning that his father blames himself for his mother's death because he himself was passing by wishing that John's mother would die so that his secret would be safe just before the foul ball was hit. So just as Owen does, John's father sees himself as having a relationship with God and God working through him. So that night, John brings the dressmaker's form to the church outside where his father's working late at night, throws the baseball bat in the window, and the pastor looks out and mistakes the dressmaker's form for John's mother, Tabitha, has a conversion experience where he absolutely believes in God and goes on to become a devout preacher from that point forward. On the one hand, it's dealt with very straight. On the other hand, it's so ridiculous. I just don't know what to do with that, other than I want to know if Irving is inviting us to engage in skepticism about the other aspects of this book, the other miraculous aspects of the book, when he has a miracle like this, which is so comical and improbable.
Well, I have to say, at the very beginning of the book, when Irving is setting up, kind of where he is present day, and then he's thinking back on his childhood and Owen and the whole thing, it's fairly clear, at least the narrator of the book seems to be struggling with his own faith, right? And he's struggling with his faith. And so I feel like I believe in Owen and I believe in his story, right? And I feel like Owen, at least for the narrator, Owen is what is keeping this man, is keeping him in his faith, is the whole story of Owen, right? So I think there are some of those stories within the story, if you will, like, John's father's reveal and the whole dress form thing. I feel like that dress form just kept being called back and used in fairly ridiculous ways, but I feel like some of that is that story of is your faith real? Is your faith grounded on anything real? John's father was actually a preacher, but a small man, not very strong in his faith or even as a person. And then this kind of ridiculous incident thrust him into having a stronger faith. So I think there's, again, a lot of questions of faith and what your faith is based on. And I'll say this just on a very personal note. When I read this book, it was at a point in my life that I was having a lot of questions about faith as well. And so I think that's probably one of the reasons the book had such an impact on me at that point, is that when you are, I think it gives you an opportunity to question, what is your faith based on? Is it real, or do you have your faith because your family believes something? Do you believe it? Does it take something sensational like the ending of this book to have faith? So I think he may do some of that purposefully, just to make you question, why do you believe what you believe, or do you believe it at all?
The present day bits where John is looking back are rife with John's complaints about the political situation of 1987, specifically his anger towards the Reagan administration and its dealings in Nicaragua at the time. For those of us who actually lived through the Reagan administration, Reagan was not a very popular president during his first term. He kind of flagged along for a while, and then there was an assassination attempt on his life that made him highly sympathetic to a lot of people. But by the time the Reagan administration was dying down, it was coming to its end in 1988, we were going through Iran-Contra, and Reagan was leaving office on a kind of a low point. People were, again, not very happy with the administration. Then in the 90s, a new generation of conservatism in this country picked up Reagan as this exemplar of smaller government, anti-taxes, and they saw him as having been instrumental in bringing about the end of the Cold War. And so his star rose very much in the 90s. When Irving was writing this book, the Reagan legacy was not really necessarily in good shape at this point. So it's interesting to read that for me. But the But I find myself actually very frustrated with old John Wheelwright, because all he does is complain, and he's very angry with the world. He's angry with the church he attends now. Mm-hmm. He's angry with his cousin Hester, who we haven't mentioned before.
Yeah.
Hester is a character who keeps showing up in the book, who is one of three cousins he has, who eventually develops a sexual romantic relationship with Owen, but kind of stands in for Young's sexuality for both characters. She's this figure of lust for both John and Owen. What did you make of Hester? Because I didn't find her to be much of a character.
Well, you know, yeah, Hester was interesting because you already pointed out that Owen, you know, had the hots for John's mother. And then Hester, I felt like was a big tease for Owen, right? And she just tormented Owen when he was younger, but was unattainable because in some ways, even though she wasn't related to Owen, she was kind of, since Owen was so much a part of John's family, it was almost like he was part of the family, and Hester was like this unattainable, and she was slightly older than Owen, or at least in my mind she was, maybe I'm wrong on that, but yeah, to me she was just like this, Hester would come in, tease Owen, you know, get him all excited and then run away. So I have to admit, and as many times as I read the book, I was always surprised later in the book when Hester and Owen actually developed a relationship, when they were actually a couple. So she was an interesting, she's kind of a surprise element, but yeah, I didn't have much. It's not like she was one of my favorite characters, but to your point, maybe they just needed to give him some kind of romantic relationship, because Owen obviously was a challenging character to put in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about this book, though, is there any book that deals with children growing through their adolescence will probably touch upon issues of sexuality.
Sure.
And of discovery of sexuality. But this book, one of the things that I found disappointing about this book, that I kind of suspect that this is one of the things that I do associate Irving with, that tradition of Updike and Roth and Norman Mailer and so on, is it's a book that seems to have a lot of resentment for women, and particularly resentment for the fact that women have a sexual attraction to men. It's this adolescent internalization of blaming the object of desire, rather than realizing, oh, well, I have this desire, I have to deal with it. Because not only Hester, there's also a character, Barb, in the book, who is the wife of the minister. And there's a sequence where Owen is playing baby Jesus in a Christmas pageant. It's actually a very long sequence in the middle of the book where Owen is playing both baby Jesus in one Christmas pageant and the ghost of Christmas Future in a production of A Christmas Carol. This runs for like three chapters in the book, and the chapters in this book are like 100 pages each. They're very long. And Barb picks up Owen to settle him down in the manger and purposefully brushes her breasts against him to cause him to become aroused. And Owen is resentful and angry about this. And I think that Irving expects us as readers to think, oh, those wicked women and their wily ways. That kind of bugged me about this book. And by the end of the book, John himself has become a sullen virgin who's decided he doesn't want to have anything to do with women. Hester has become improbably a rock star in the burgeoning days of MTV. A lot of time is spent talking about the music videos she's in, which also dates this book quite a bit. So it's not a great book, I think, for the female characters.
Yeah, I will say the one, I feel like some of this, obviously, when they're children, that's in the 50s, and so I felt like the roles of women and men, I don't know, but maybe it didn't surprise me. The way women are treated is kind of reflective a little bit of that time. But although I did feel like, I did like Owen's mother's character. Unfortunately, she died young, but I like the fact that she, had Owen out of, and wasn't married, never revealed the father. I kind of did things her own way. I felt like she was probably she was a fairly strong character. And of course, John chose to kill her. But she was a very strong, like, helper. Never said who the father was. Did things her own way. I actually liked her character and was, unfortunately we lost her young. But she was probably one of the more independent, interesting characters. And unfortunately, she had to die.
I completely agree with you. I think that she was a vivacious character, and I admired her, all the things you say about that, because she was not going to be shamed by society for being a unwed mother in the 50s. But there is something weird about the way that she's killed young that allows her to stay in some ways immaculate. Mm-hmm. I guess that's a good word to use in a book like this. she's the mother, and this is, and I think the women in this book definitely fall either in Madonna or whore territory.
Yeah, that's true. And even grandma was kind of an evil mother, evil woman, right? and I want to go back to his father, John's father, for just a minute, because I know when I've read that book, the many times I've read it, it always reminds me of The Scarlet Letter, that whole relationship was that Hester? Is that character?
Hester, yes.
Hester and the preacher having the relationship that's hidden, and you don't find out about it until much later. And that minister, the way he's portrayed reminds me of the minister in The Scarlet Letter. That whole relationship always made me think of that. And I don't think that was intentional, or maybe it was, but that always made me think of it.
I think it was absolutely intentional. Yeah. I think that's a great thing to bring up. I think that this is a book that plays a lot of literary games. I think that definitely The Scarlet Letter is being referenced. Reading essays on this book, the other major figure for this book, or prefiguration for this book, was Gunter Grass's The Tin Drum, which the main character, Oscar Matsura, is supposed to be very close to Owen Meany in characterization. Now, I have never read The Tin Drum, so I only have this commentary to go on, but anyone who's interested can go online and read about the parallels. They do seem very, very strong, and apparently Irving has acknowledged this as an inspiration. Before we go on way too long, let's talk about the end of the book. One thing that's been happening that happens throughout the book is, as Owen slowly comes to believe that he is chosen by God as an instrument of God, as he comes to believe that he has been given a glimpse at the date of his own death, which happens during the scene in which he plays the Ghost of Christmas Future, he increasingly becomes obsessed with playing this game with John, of John carrying him up on his arms so that he can make a basketball shot, mm-hmm. which would be impossible for someone his size otherwise to do. And he practices with John over and over, obsessively, trying to cut down the amount of time that it takes to perfect this shot, and telling John that it will be important at some point, which it eventually turns out to become important at the end of the book. You want to give away the shock ending of the prayer for Owen?
No. It's a great ending in the sense that it kind of connects all the dots, but it's a very sad ending.
I don't want to traumatize you.
Yeah, no.
Then
you can say it.
Okay, so Owen, as Owen's visions become more detailed and pronounced. He believes that he will be called upon to save Vietnamese children and die in the arms of a nun. He enlists to go fight in Vietnam. He is not sent, though, to the front lines. He becomes instead an officer who's responsible for the transport of bodies back home to America. He calls John up on the phone to come meet him in Phoenix, Arizona, where he is responsible for the return of the body of a dead soldier. And at the airport, a group of nuns is escorting some Vietnamese war orphans through the airport. The angry and murderous brother of the soldier who is dead appears with a grenade in his hand and throws it into the bathroom where the children are huddled, and John catches the grenade. He passes it to Owen, picks Owen up, and Owen basically slam dunks it out into a little window transom that's high above the sinks. He holds it there with his arms, and the grenade goes off, blowing Owen's arms off, but not hurting anyone else. And so Owen does die in the arms of a nun, saving Vietnamese children. And what's remarkable about the end of this book to me is again, it happens so rapidly. Uh-huh. In the last, I don't know, five or 10 pages of the book, to the point that I was a little bit confused at first as to who the assailant was, because he had just been introduced earlier that chapter. Mm-hmm. and why he was there. I'm still not exactly sure how he got his hands on a grenade.
Well, I guess in theory, too, if he was a soldier, he may have still have been dressed, you know, from the... I know when my brother was came back from the First Persian Gulf War, he was still carrying this gun. And I'm like, really? I mean, he still had ammo with him. And I think, that is what happened in the book, except in that I don't remember that detail, but... I'm always surprised that they would let them walk into the airport still carrying ammunition.
So this is the miracle at the end of the book that leads John begrudgingly to acknowledge that God is real. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of ways you can take this. You can, if you take it in the literal sense that Meany was correct, God was working through him all the time, then there's the troubling question of why such a convoluted path, why a lot of things get explained at the end of this book, such as the fact that Owen needed to be a small person so that he wouldn't scare the children. He needed to have a high voice to put them at ease. These could be true. These could be things that John makes up after the fact to try to make even more sense out of the situation. But even if we do believe that this was all God's plan, the question then becomes, is Irving positing a world in which everything is fated? Is it cruel to make people into your instruments if you're just going to sacrifice them? But of course, that's the story of Christ.
Right. Yeah, you know, I think, to your point, it is a really specific, you know, the ending is, like I said, kind of tragic. If you've read the whole book and you've gotten kind of invested in Owen, and then he dies in such a, you know, kind of tragic and brutal way. Although to me it was kind of, the ending was brutal, but in some ways, because of all the symbolism and all the, everything that had gone, it made sense. You're kind of like, oh, Owen's life it made a difference. This is why Owen was the way he was. This is why he lived his life the way he did. And so he died for a reason, right? And I think, especially since this was at that time, that was Vietnam, right? Maybe that in some ways, you know, so many people died at that time. I don't know, for some reason it makes you feel a little bit better, or it made John feel a little bit better, right? And I think anybody who's, and for me, like I said, I had a real personal experience. If you dealt with death, and you have and you can't explain why somebody died the way they did, or why did people go through so much pain, or why. And then if you sit there, and if there's any way to say, well, there's a reason they died, or look, they did this, or it doesn't, I don't think it necessarily means that God, you know, that you're put on this earth to die, but it just, I don't know, it makes it seem a little more, I don't know, it just makes you feel like there's a reason for all this. There's a reason for pain, right? There's a reason for pain. I think at the time I read it, it made me feel a little bit better about things that had been happening in my life. Now if I read it, I don't know if I'd have quite that, you know, like, oh wow, this makes so much sense. But at the time at least, I was having a little bit of the same reaction to it as John did, as John, you know, Wheelwright did. So it helped. I think it helped.
When I was a kid, I had a favorite Aesop's fable, and it's probably one that isn't well known by anyone out there. It's not like a country mouse, city mouse thing. Mm-hmm. It's not an Androcles and the Lion kind of story. There was a story about a lion and a man are arguing about which is better, lions or men, and the man says, "Look, I can prove it to you that men are better. Come with me." He takes him to see a statue that someone has made of a man killing a lion. He says, "Look at that statue." And the lion says, "That doesn't prove anything. If lions could make statues, we could make a statue of a lion killing a man." And I love that story because it's about the way in which art lies to people. and part of what's weird about this book, in a way, is this book is about a miracle that forces the character to believe in God. But that miracle was made up by John Irving. And so as a critical reader, you're left with all kinds of questions about what you're supposed to come away from this book with. I think that actually is smart and purposeful on John Irving's part. I think that Irving did not necessarily mean this book to be a book that would reignite anyone's faith. I think this is a book that he made to like seriously examine, as you said, why do people believe what they mm-hmm. believe, and what do you, reader, believe, and why do you, reader, believe what you believe. Mm-hmm. It's a smart book. It's a book that has left me a little bit puzzled, and I guess that's a good thing.
And I said, that's why I think, yeah, it's the one that really benefits from rereading, even though I know it's a long book, because I think it's pretty artfully put together, and because it's very complex, and I think that I like the language, and I love the characters, even though some of them are annoying, and some of them are, yeah, you know, like a little bit cartoonish, but I think that the world that, and he really has put together a world that's very complete, and like I said, Owen Meany is one of my favorite characters ever. I'm just really sad he's not a real person, because I would love to meet this guy. And you know, there has been a movie made based on the book, but it's not called A Prayer for Owen Meany. It's called Simon Birch. And they took horrendous liberties. I would say it was inspired by the book, but not based on the book. And they had to change quite a bit of the storyline. But they did try to recreate the Owen Meany character, but he's a really hard character to actually bring to life, because, you know, but it's Simon Birch, so if you're interested, you know, take a look at the movie and see what they tried to do.
And I have a suggestion for you, Carla, and for all the readers out there. The final thing that this book reminded me of very much is the book by Robertson Davies, Fifth Business, which was published in 1970. Robertson Davies is well known in Canada as one of their premier novelists. He's even more like Charles Dickens than Irving is, much more like Charles Dickens. Fifth Business is actually the first book of a trilogy. But the reason it reminds me of Owen Meany is it starts in a small town, I believe, like somewhere in Ontario, called Deptford, and it features boys growing up and one of them throws a snowball containing a rock at another, and it hits the wife of the local Baptist minister and renders her simple, as they say. She becomes mentally disabled, but she becomes, in the eyes of the young character Dunstan Ramsay, who's telling the story, she becomes saint-like. Ramsay is not Catholic, but he becomes obsessed with the lives of saints, and he becomes convinced that Mary Dempster, this young Baptist minister's wife, is a saint. And it has a very similar start. It starts with an accident involving the beautiful mother of one of the characters and the ambivalent feelings that the main character has about this, and it becomes a lifelong obsession of Dunstan Ramsay as to issues of faith and sainthood. So if you liked Prayer for Owen and Mimi, maybe check this book out.
I haven't read that. I will definitely try it.
Any last words to...
I still want people to give it a try. I know it's a long book, but I still read it once a year, and I love it every time. So give Owen and Mimi a try. I think you're really liking it.
And thanks so much for getting me to read it. I want to say I really had a good time reading it, although I may sound a little more hot and cold in this discussion. It's because it's left me puzzled.
See, I think that's great. I think that's a great reaction. It puzzled you. You didn't have like a yes or no. You're still in the middle somewhere. That's great. You need to read it again.
Thanks to my co-host, Carla Kurtzinger. Carla doesn't have a webpage, so if you want to find more of her, look for a tall, redheaded Kentuckian at your local airport. The reading this time was by Moises Kahulian. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write to us at sophomore.literature@gmail.com or join in on Facebook or the Slack. Next time, a super spooky Sophomore Lit as we read H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. Keep up the reading, and remember, everything will be on the final.